not to twist your words, but if I understood when you were talking about kind of the disconnect between your father's passion about environmentalism and your passion about human issues, it kind of rang a bell in my head about the many ways I feel like we as a culture both set ourselves up as individuals to an inaccurate and unrealistic extent, but also hold ourselves out separate from nature. And it feels like kind of what you're talking about is the way in which we exist within a system. I mean, I know certainly in psychology, there's theories around family systems. And this is a thing I struggle with even as a parent, where it's like, if I put my kid into the gym's daycare so that I can go work out, is that for me or is it for them? Because that I'm part of the system and caretaking me means also caretaking them in a certain way. And I feel like there's a recursive nature to both being herd animals and just living within an ecosystem. It feels like you're kind of naming here in some ways. Am I misunderstanding that or?
Well, I think you also offered a lot of tentacles there too. There's a lot of different ways to parse out some of what you said. I do think to go towards one of them and one out of the many that is really a key part of climate psychology and how it interweaves with an understanding of capitalism and how it an understanding of human alienation writ large is the degree to which, particularly in neoliberal societies and economies, it is very much premised on human beings separate from and dominating and using the land and resources in an extractive way. Mm-hmm. And it's not recognizing to any conscious degree in the ways we plan and organize society, how utterly dependent we are and interwoven with the larger ecosystem of the more than human, of the non-human, of an entire planetary landscape. And I had never really understood what it meant to be sort of anthropocentric. And I still deeply, deeply prioritize human suffering when I think about where my own priorities are and why I'm most motivated. I can't pretend that I'm ultimately more motivated by what happens to other species or the non-human world. I do still get deeply and primarily drawn to human suffering, in part because I'm human. But my whole frame of reference has shifted that our quality of life is so deeply interwoven with the ways we shepherd and participate and regard ourselves as part of the larger ecosystem, both as dependent as well as caretaking, and things to learn from that system. I think I came with really pretty traditional, even if it was disguised as kind of leftist dogma, a pretty traditional kind of split between the human environment and the more than human environment. And it blinded me to not only issues of environmental justice and environmental racism and environmental inequities and water supply, air supply, pollution, all of the other things that were truly and despicably not on my radar. So not only did it wake me up to all of that stuff, but in the much more spiritual and psychological sense, how we are not only dependent on humans in our life, but we are dependent on a climate of stability and how much our sense of self and safety and security depends on things that we don't actually acknowledge we're dependent on. It's disowned dependency. And what does that mean psychologically? Yeah. Yet again, more tentacles in that question, but it really exposed to me very quickly what I had not seen. And at some level, I think what I refuse to see, because I don't think acknowledging the state of one's dependency on things outside of ourselves as human beings is a scary thing to acknowledge. And to acknowledge the interrelatedness and the codependencies is very anathema to the individualist model that you were just describing. And I think an explicit and implicit part of climate psychology is a full repudiation of that individualist framework in both the psychological, the economic, the emotional, the social, in every kind of way.
If I had hours and hours, I would ask all the follow-up questions I want. But you did brush up against the notion of caregiver just now. I'm out of concern that we not, you know, myself and anyone listening to this, not collapse that into whatever schema I've built up about what a caregiver is. Do you mind just, so we're all on the same page, putting that into your own words? What do you consider a caregiver?
Well, this is a real challenge, how to generalize the concept of a caregiver so that the caregiver is giving care to both individuals, to a flower, to a community, to the future generations. What does it mean to be a caregiver? I think it means that we are recognizing, this is so beautifully challenging. that we are recognizing a sense of responsibility to be responsive to the needs of the other. Mm-hmm. And that as we are responsive to the needs of the other, that also grows our capacity to be healthy human beings, healthy. So I think a true caregiving relationship is not unidirectional. It's multidirectional. And in the best sense, I mean, you and I were just talking about parenting before we started, is that the relationship between a caregiver and one and that which is being cared for is so interactive. We get changed in the process of taking care of, and what we are taking care of also then benefits from our nurturing, and back and forth. And that's the symbiotic relationship that I think is horribly disrupted in so many different ways in our society, in very literal ways in terms of the attack on parents and the attack on genuine family health in terms of childcare laws and wage laws and housing and all the other ways in which families are forced to sort of navigate things as individual units and not social systems and all of those other kinds of things, but in all the other ways that these are attacked. The symbiotic relationship and the best sense of mutual dependency.
What is the importance of a caregiver, both in the context of our climate, but how we support each other in our experience of this moment?
This might be a sideways answer to what you're saying, but oftentimes people ask, what does it mean to be active around issues of climate if we're not going to be able to see the impact of what we do, or if the scale of what needs to be done is so dramatically bigger than what I individually can contribute to. And in many respects, that's a really fair question. Again, so much of society is organized around tangible and concrete manifested outcomes. And Sarah Jaquette Ray writes about this beautifully in her book, How to Live in a Hot Climate, I think is what it's called. But she writes about, and I've run with in my own head and in my own thinking, is how vital it is that we disconnect from an immediate one-to-one correlation between what we do and what outcomes we see out there in the world. And this jives with my sense of psychology. I've never been a behaviorist. I don't particularly like evidence-based models. So that was not so hard for me. But for a lot of people who grow up and think in these terms and have been encouraged to think about these terms, it can be really, really disconcerting to not be able to see the immediate benefits of what you're doing compared to what you know is so massive. And that's where I go to the question about meaning making. And maybe this is weaves back into the caretaking, is that if we can imagine ourselves as being part of, again, that ecosystem, part of a larger story of being alive on this planet, of contributing to the health and welfare of not only ourselves and other people and other non-human lives, that gives us a sense that we are part of. That's meaning making, that we are creating a sense of importance to our life that is not about an outcome, but about participating in a larger story and a larger sense of contribution that links us to literally millions of people around the world who are doing this kind of work. And that not only sort of takes the pressure and the burden off, but it also gives you a sense of companionship, a sense of collectivity. Again, outside of the individualist model framework, the individualist carbon footprint model, which is what we are fed by the fossil fuel industry, that that's the way to contribute is to reduce your carbon footprint, as if that's available to the vast majority of people. But it also, that just reaffirms that our only capacity in the world is as consumers of this or that, and not as meaning makers, as relationship builders, as caretakers of each other and the rest of the world and the planet. And so this is really an invitation to much more substantially broaden what our sense of capacity is. And I'm not sure that that gets to your question, but hopefully it circles back.
No, that absolutely does. I mean, I certainly wholeheartedly relate to the experience of sometimes feeling paralyzed in the scale of it all. And I think what you're naming is that there's still a capacity there to create meaning, even when it doesn't feel like I can measure my impact. And I guess I feel like, yeah, it's funny that notion of capacity, the model that puts the onus to solve climate change on the individual is for me an incapacitating model. It makes me feel like I don't want to participate because it just feels impossible. It feels Sisyphusian. But to think about the ways in which I can create meaning independent of that, that's a very empowering perspective. So you've worn many hats in your life, many of them caretaking hats. We touched briefly about your experience of attempting to confront climate change with very young kids. Do you have any, you know, having lived that and now you don't have very young kids, what advice would you give to a parent of a five-year-old whose father gives them a book on climate change and can't tolerate reading it?
Okay, so I come back to the attachment lens that I come from and why I think the field of climate psychology is so important and how it weaves with other things I have always cared about in my life, is that to the extent that parents can't hold certain fears in mind, then they can't be present for their children as they hold those fears in mind. And the analogy about, you know, when we have kids who wake up with nightmares, right, is if a kid in the middle of the night wakes up in a nightmare, a parent has a lot of different ways to respond depending on who that parent is. If a parent responds and says, oh, it's nothing, go to bed, that's one response. If the parent responds, oh my God, it's terrifying, what are we going to do? That's another response. And then there's the response, yeah, dreams are really scary sometimes, and I'm here to help you figure out how to go back to sleep, right? That's the equivalent, I think, of what parenting would be around climate change, is that the most important thing a parent can do is to actually confront the question themselves, is to not avoid like I did, even though it's deeply understandable and it's scary and we need support as we do it, because the information is not comforting by any stretch of the imagination. But the more that we can take in the reality of it, the more we can manage our own feelings of helplessness, of fear, of catastrophic dread, of whatever image of dystopian ideas that we get that are these hybrids of real and fantastical, given sort of our own stories and histories. The more we have room to process all of that comfortably and without judgment and with a sense of companionship, the more we can be there for our kids. So when they ask questions that start out, they have no idea what they're asking. They don't know the existential crisis at certain stages. At 5 years old, they don't know that when they're asking, how come there's no snow this year, that what they're asking is something that is deeply threatening to us as adults, right? Mm-hmm. They're just asking something very, like, it was here last year. Why isn't it now, right?
Right.
We have to be able to tolerate those feelings enough to be able to answer our kid with a sense of curiosity, a sense of openness, a sense of exploration. What can we do? Oh, and then think about sort of, there's a lot of other things. And so I think the biggest and most important thing is that parents themselves get supported, which is why in the Climate Psychology Alliance, we think and talk a lot about climate cafes. I don't know if you've heard of the concept of a climate cafe. And we're sort of tinkering with it in different ways. But the entire premise of it is that, again, as Catherine Hayhoe writes, who's a climate scientist, the vast majority of people are concerned about climate change, and yet the vast majority of people don't talk about it. And so it creates this completely false social framework that we're the only ones worried. And it's a completely false loop. No one's talking about it, so I'm the only one, so I must be kind of crazy. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to be the downer at a party, all whatever it is, that the Climate Cafe interrupts that entire setup and normalizes. These are things we can talk about. These are things that are worth naming. There are spaces that are worth grieving. How do we do that? The more we do that for ourselves, it's no different from other kinds of parenting. The more nourished and cared for that we are, the more nourished and cared for our kid is. So you going to the gym really does nourish you and will come back and nourish your kid, right? It really is that. Instead of this guilt kind of, I always have to be 24/7 with my kid. Like how do we expand our own capacity to receive that care? And that's in the context of climate too. And I think once that openness is generated in a parent, I mean, I have been in many, many climate cafes. Once that openness to the fear and the feelings emerge, the next steps about how to help your kid are pretty obvious, actually. It's not that rocket science. Is you teach them to love nature, most importantly. You teach them to go towards what they love, to take care of what they love. Mm. You teach them the relationships between themselves and the broader world. And you teach them to be curious and all of those other things. And then you teach them about the caretakers. Who are the helpers around us? So I certainly think, again, age appropriate, that's how I would definitely work with kids younger than sort of elementary school age.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it feels like, you know, part of the role of a parent is helping to solidify or form some kind of moral framework. And I guess I'm just noticing that, like, yes, of course, we would teach our kids to take care of nature because we would teach them to take care of things generally because that's a respectful and ethical way to be in the world. But we have so many structures, it feels, to hold ourselves out as separate from nature in such a way that I don't see. It almost feels like part of the mission here is to dissolve some of those boundaries, dissolving the boundaries you were talking about when your dad gave you that book on environmentalism. I think similarly, like dissolving the boundary between, you know, you don't hit your friends, you know, that same moral code that informs caring about and considering the other person needs to pervade your experience of the rest of the world too. That's very interesting.
That it's not a transactional relationship between humans and the natural environment in which they live or which has been exploited or destroyed around them. And that raises a lot of different questions depending on the geography where people live. In Montana, that's a very different question than people growing up in cement-dominated heat traps of New York City. And it takes on very, very different questions, but yeah.
Well, kind of more broadly, not just the five-year-old, how you know, you kind of made a glancing blow at this, but how would you talk to kids in general? I know that's a very broad brush to be painting with. How did you, maybe we can start with your personal experience. How did you talk to your kids about this?
As they were growing
up? Do not use me as a good example. I've probably done everything wrong. I get moralistic and preachy and lectury and I turn I am not the paragon of healthy parenting on this kind of question. I'm not joking, actually. I think that's actually kind of important to name again, is that when we have our own panics and we have our own investments and how our children are in the world, how not to smother their own orientation, their own interests, their own flicker of wherever it goes. And I think in particular at early stages of my own climate awareness, actually, I was very brittle. I was very preachy. Mm. It was the equivalent of my dad giving me at every single gift giving opportunity, yet another book about climate change, right? Mm. As if there was nothing else we could ever talk about. And I am fairly certain that I was like that at the beginning because I felt so profoundly shaken by what I was learning. I didn't have a way to modulate. I didn't have grace and forgiveness in how I adjusted my messaging. And I felt a sense of panic and I felt a sense of moral abrasiveness. I was instantly like, I cut out meat. I did a lot of different sort of lifestyle changes because I felt such intense fear. And it was only as I also processed my own relationship to the question, the duration of the question, what is the role of individual consumption versus individual action? Are those the same thing? That I was able to relax how I treated my kids. That they had much more room to ask questions and find their own way rather than me being dogmatic. And I say that because I think when we think about talking to older kids, there's a model out there about activism. And I mean, especially in Montana with the lawsuits and all of that stuff, it's like there is one model that you have to devote 24/7. And if you don't devote 24/7, then you suck. Or you're immoral, or you're indulging, or you're something. And I think it's really, really important that we again talk to kids about meaning making. What do they love about their life? What do they love about how they go about their world, their friendships, their music, their studies? Because quite literally everything we do can have climate implications. And whether we sing about climate, whether we study climate, whether we do films, it does not have to look a certain way. And you don't have to prove your viability through individual consumption choices. And I do work with teenagers, and I especially worked with teenagers a lot before, that the overlap between profound kind of personal guilt and rules about how one should behave can really couple with teen identity stuff, and it can be brutal and ruthless. Which is why it's one other way in which I think the carbon footprint model is so devastating for teenagers in particular, because it can become an incredibly self-loathing, self-deprivation, I'm guilty, I'm bad, and then it can turn into this very brittle relationship with other people. So when I think about youth who want to be active, the approach I take is always make it relational, always make it about connecting with other people, spreading good ideas, spreading collaboration, having a good time doing it, all of those kinds of things, taking breaks. And if it's people who are not involved in climate, I mean, that's a harder question because I don't really see those kids as much. I work with climate activists, and so they announce themselves that these are issues on their mind. I guess I would say that I think that there's a very big problem in the way the narrative of climate is in the media, which is exceedingly disempowering and catastrophic, which doesn't mean that there isn't room and reason to be very, very worried, deeply worried. But the narrative in the media is so disenfranchising and does not speak about collective action, does not foreground mutual solution making or anything like that, which is why I'm involved in a project through CPA called the Trauma-Informed Climate Journalism Project, where we're really trying to write a guide about rewriting how we talk about climate in the media. And I'm doing that with several climate journalists, because I think teens are absorbing that exceedingly depressing norm that there's a lot to dread in our future. That's hardly a motivating place from which to act.
Well, on the other side of that, you're very engaged with this work. What is it that you do to maintain hope? What sustains your passion and resilience in the face of a very hard problem?
Well, some of it is that I do a lot of art. I used to do much, much more photography, but during the pandemic, I got pretty sick and tired of the screen, including the screen of a camera. And I think as I became much more climate aware, I started getting involved in pottery. And so I do things with my hands. I do things with my body. I embody and I work with, and there's something incredibly magical about working with clay. So for me, being part of creating something, and in particular, creating something out of the earth, feels unbelievably replenishing and essential. And I notice it when I don't do it. Getting physical exercise, all of those things, remembering that we are bodies in the world and that that's part of what's nice to be alive, you know, all of those other kinds of things. But honestly, I am practicing what I preach. I make meaning out of what I'm doing too. Like I have no illusion that my doing this work in this Climate Psychology Alliance is going to stop climate change. I have no illusion that I will see the solutions in my lifetime. I don't. I have no illusions about that. And yet I need to feel, as a human being rooted in this world, that I am part of a solution, part of breaking down the psychological barriers to name things, part of addressing the fears, part of creating space to stay with the problem. I find that to be tremendously meaningful. So it is a version of taking action. So oftentimes, what is the remedy to climate anxiety is to take action. I don't think all action is created equal. I think some actions can actually deplete us and make us feel worse, namely the carbon footprint model. But the kind of action that I'm taking is profoundly relational, is building something larger than myself, is contributing to a larger dialogue that I really, really believe in. And that, as I get older and less grandiose, I thought I was going to be at the forefront of a revolution, for example, when I was in my 20s. That is enough. That is enough for me, because I think it's the most honest. And I am learning to accept what's true about my capacity and to lean into that and then do it as much as I can.